This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the debate over military action in Syria today moves to Russia, and mostly behind closed doors among world leaders at the G20 summit in St. Petersburg. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the votes are starting to count as the House and Senate consider a resolution authorizing Syrian intervention. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday voted 10-7 for intervention. More on Congress later in the hour. But the G20 summit was already distracted by the tensions between Russia and the U.S. over NSA leaker Edward Snowden and Vladimir Putin's decision to give the wanted fugitive asylum in Russia long before this latest Syrian crisis. The idea that a global summit would be dominated by tensions between the U.S. and a Russian leader harkens back to the days of the Cold War, even though these issues, Snowden and Syria, are not really Cold War issues. Joining us now is Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist, author of Deception, the Inside Story of East-West Espionage Today. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hello, John. Nice to talk to you.
So we got a handshake there between Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin. Not much of a kiss, but these two are predisposed to be pretty chilly with each other. What do you make of it?
Well, I think you're right that it's chilly, if anything, is an understatement. This is probably the worst East-West relations we've had since the Soviet Union, and not even the end of the Soviet Union. I'm thinking of the mid-1980s before Mikhail Gorbachev came in. And this is, I think, really the result of Mr. Putin coming to power back in 1999. It's taken the West a long time to wake up and see what kind of regime this really is. But anti-Westernism has been becoming more and more prominent. And I think in the end, even the administration can't fail to notice it, whether it's on Syria or whether it's on Edward Snowden, as you mentioned, or on other issues too.
Well, on the question of Syria, China has agreed with Russia on the question of non-intervention in Syria. Is that going to have implications for other issues at the summit?
Chinese position's a bit different. The Chinese don't like the idea of unilateral Western intervention, but they also don't want a big war in the Middle East because they're a big oil importer. Russia actually likes tension in the Middle East because when there's tension, the oil price goes up, and that means free money for Putin. So I think if Russia was determined to put pressure on Assad and try and get into the negotiating table, and if that pressure involved the threat of UN-backed sanctions and military strikes and so on, I don't think the Chinese would stand in its way. But the Chinese have a pretty dim view of Mr. Putin. They see Russia as an extraordinarily badly run country that they don't want to rely on too much.
So Putin is hosting this G20 summit. Does that translate, along with all of this tension, into any sort of influence and leverage on the issues? Or is Putin simply going to be tolerated by the members, by the world leaders present?
At the table for the G20, because Russia is a big country and the G20 is a collection of big countries. They're not all democracies. They're not all particularly well run. They're not all particularly advanced. I think the big question really is over Russia's role in the G8, which is supposed to be the world's big democratic countries, America, Canada, Britain, and so on. And I think it's increasingly clear that Mr. Putin, particularly in his current very anti-Western framework, doesn't really belong at the table when the big Western club is meeting. And I think, in a way, Russia has sidelined itself. It could be a country that was helping to fix the world's problems, instead of which it's turned itself into a country that is aggravating them.
Finally, anything to look for in terms of Obama and Putin, in the sense that perhaps Syria makes it more likely that there might be accommodation on the Snowden issue or any other issue on the table?
I think things are going to get worse rather than better in U.S.-Russian relations. Mr. Obama really pushed the boat out. He really tried to reset relations with Russia when he first came in. He then was trying very hard to make a success of the Medvedev presidency. He's really bet quite hard on improving things. It hasn't worked out, and it's, if anything, a bit of a humiliation for him. So he feels quite burned by Mr. Putin, and he, I think, is going to devote his attention to other things, which is why he didn't go for a bilateral meeting with Mr. Putin, but went to Sweden instead.
Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Edward Lucas is the author of Deception, the Inside Story of East-West Espionage Today. So let's get some views on the Syrian intervention a little closer to home. Yesterday, we heard some serious skepticism about intervention in Syria from some of you out in Minnesota. Today?
Yes, Ron calling from Beaverton, Oregon. Absolutely, we should attack Syria and punish them for killing children. And President Obama is weak for even hesitating and giving responsibility to Congress. Let's go ahead with it. Don't be such a wuss, Mr. Obama.
Hi, this is Andrew from Portland. I think we should be involved in Syria if we have to be in a limited way, because I'm tired of seeing my friends going overseas to try to solve other people's problems.
Thanks to listeners Andrew and Ron there. Congressman Kurt Schrader, welcome to the program.
Welcome indeed. Thank you so much, John.
Now, Congressman, I might have to consult a very precise district map to know if those two folks were your constituents. You're speaking to us from Canby, Oregon. Is that the prevailing view in your 5th district in Oregon? Varying degrees of support for intervention? What do you think?
No, and I don't represent Oregon either, frankly. My district's the Mid-Valley and pretty conservative area, actually, for Oregon. And we're running mail and talking to folks, and it's 90% against getting involved in any way, shape, or form. I think Americans are very, very skeptical of getting involved in another war. We've gone above and beyond our call as Americans, with men and women spending serious time, effort, and blood for other people's causes, and we spend a lot of taxpayer money. Let's have the rest of the world step up along with us for a change.
So you don't think there's any sort of U.S. security interest in making a statement to prevent Bashar al-Assad from using chemical weapons?
No security interest at all. Zero. None. I mean, we have a choice now between hopefully getting an international body engaged in the chemical weapons issue, but from a security standpoint, we either looks like we have to go in and back Assad with Hezbollah and Iran committed against Israel and the avowed terrorists, or helping Al Qaeda, which is the dominant wing now, the so-called freedom fighters. I see that as a no-win for America and something we should not be getting involved in unilaterally under any circumstances.
So I gather the voice of this, maybe not constituent, but certainly Oregon citizen, is more along the lines of where you're thinking. Listen.
This is Rich Fettig from Portland, Oregon, and I just wanted to wonder if anybody's thinking about the consequences of supporting basically Al-Qaeda. I mean, half of these rebel groups are on the terrorist list. Can we at least discuss that?
Do you go along with that? Half, majority are jihadists?
Well, I can't give you a number, and I don't think even NSA or CIA can give you the exact number, but it's pretty convincing that they are a significant portion, if not the dominant force now, fighting Assad. I mean, there's no good answer out there, to be very, very honest. And I think at this point, Americans, as I said, have gone above and beyond the call of duty. This is a 21st century. This is a time when our Congress, who has the right to declare war, your first listener is incorrect. The president does not have that option. That is something that the Constitution, our founders, gave to Congress, not just one person, but 535 folks get to decide whether or not we commit American men and resources overseas. And in this case, I think the dominant view of Americans is correct, and we all listen to them. We're a representative government here, for goodness sakes. And the chemical weapons are a horrible, horrible thing. But so are massacres at the end of a machine gun or machete or whatever is going on out there. And we have to be very thoughtful about how we intervene. It's time for the world to step up. I would hope in the 21st century that the world, international organizations, would take a firm stand against chemical weapons. It is not our role to run in there like John Wayne and unilaterally dictate our terms.
Talking with Democratic Congressman from the 5th Congressional District in Oregon, Kurt Schrader. So, Congressman Schrader, some of your Republican colleagues have said that the main event here is going to be how the Democratic leadership can keep the party together on this. If there are splits within the Democratic Party, Barack Obama may end up not getting his resolution out of the House of Representatives. Do you feel any party loyalty here?
Well, I don't think this is a party issue. That is one of the few reasons I'm looking forward to going back to Congress next week, is this is an issue of the heart. This is an issue of our constituents. This is an issue of values, and each member of Congress is going to approach this differently. This has little or nothing to do with the president. As I said, this is the war powers. Declaring war in any way, shape, or form is the responsibility of Congress. And I don't think our leadership on the Democratic side is going to put a tremendous amount of pressure on us for the reason. This is a value-based judgment. This gets at people's inner conscience, and whether it's the member of Congress or their constituents. So I think it's going to be one of those where people will give their heartfelt views, and our caucus will discuss, will listen to one another. But I doubt very hard if this issue gets seriously whipped when it's a matter of individual conscience, like I said.
Whipping, referring to the party whips, keeping the party in line. And it wasn't a party line vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday. Is the town of Deadwood, Oregon, in your district, Congressman?
I don't know of a town of Deadwood in my district. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, listen to this listener, not from your district, but from the state of Oregon.
This is Michelle Holman. I'm from Deadwood, Oregon. Hey, when has bombing been the answer? Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. We don't ever look at our history. No way. We cannot go to Syria.
Now, there's another Oregon citizen seeing eye to eye with you, Kurt Schrader, sounding very much like Wayne Morse back in the Vietnam days.
Well, and I think there's a significant contingent of Oregonians that do learn from history, do see what's happened in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we've had limited success, frankly. The people in Syria don't like us. They don't like us. I don't care on which side of that conflict. They don't want us there. I think we ought to respect their wishes as much as the wishes of American citizens to limit any engagement here. And frankly, I would hope that the president would be inclined to respect Congress's wishes, however it comes out at the end of the day. After all, he did come into his presidency in 2009 saying, you know, that this was going to be more of an international approach to things. We were not going to do it the George Bush way. Let's walk our talk now.
All right. Kurt Schrader, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Kurt Schrader is the Democratic congressman representing Oregon's 5th congressional district. He sounds like a no vote opposing unilateral U.S. action in Syria. And a lot of you out there are looking for answers. Many of you have asked about the extent of the extremists in the Syrian opposition. The congressman suggested it might be as many as half. Some lawmakers insisted yesterday in the House committee hearings that the opposition is overwhelmed with jihadists. Secretary of State John Kerry was precise yesterday. He says 15% and 25%, between 15 and 25% of the rebels fighting Bashar al-Assad. Moderate forces, he says, are growing stronger as a result of support from regional allies. It's a minority of jihadists. I just don't agree that a majority are al-Qaeda and the bad guys, Kerry said. That's not true. A lot of questions for you on Facebook. Kurt writes, if we act at all, what's the end game? What does this mean? We're taking the side of the rebels. Who else is joining us on this mission? What is America's vision of a post-war Syria? Leslie had this question. What comes after the bombs? Abdul Ghani Sankari asks, how can you make sure that Assad and his thugs are brought to justice for killing more than 100,000 innocents? And what is the price if we do not act now? And here's one from Kerry Bird Jr. Why have two administrations done nothing for Darfur in Sudan, where 400,000 men, women, and children have been murdered and gang raped the last 10 years? Why does Congress and the president now want to suddenly play global humanitarian? We may have an answer for Kerry coming up, a conversation about the lack of consistency and credibility in U.S. Middle East policy with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. That's next. Yesterday in Sweden, on his way to the G20 summit, the president repeated something he has often said when announcing matters of foreign policy.
The international community's credibility is on the line. And America and Congress's credibility is on the line because we give lip service to the notion that these international norms are important.
In this case, the credibility the president is referring to is a response to Syria's use of chemical weapons. But the president has evoked this notion of U.S. credibility in his policy during the Arab Spring, the conflict in Libya, support for Afghanistan and Iraq. Credibility was very much on the mind of Republican Congressman Ted Poe of Texas in the hearings yesterday before the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
It seems to me that we have a credibility problem because our foreign policy in the Middle East is inconsistent. Our enemies really don't know what our foreign policy is. Our friends don't know what it is, and I'm not so sure Americans know what our foreign policy is in the Middle East.
Joining me now is Nicholas Kristof, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and columnist for our partner, the New York Times. Nicholas, welcome back.
Good to be with you, John.
You know, Ted Poe is a long-standing antagonist of the Democrats and the Obama administration, but I was pretty struck by that question. Do you think he's right?
I do think that there are a lot of people in the Middle East who wonder about the resolve of the U.S. Now, I mean, frankly, I think that's partly for good reasons. They think that, you know, because we walked away from Mubarak, for example, and in retrospect, I still think we were right to do that. It seems to me that, yes, there is a credibility problem, a credibility issue, but that, you know, in the larger scheme of things, the really important issue here is less credibility than it is chemical weapons. You know, if issue were a more minor one, then I'd be more willing to walk away from the credibility issue.
Is credibility the wrong word here? Is he basically looking for some sort of logical consistency, which can often never be achieved when a superpower confronts different nations, different relationships around the world?
I think that there really is something useful in a major power projecting a sense of predictability. And it's true that in this case, particularly when Obama went to Congress, he surprised everybody and pulled the rug out from John Kerry, among others. But, you know, I also do think that, I would have been very happy if President Bush had shown less predictability and had changed his approach in, early 2003 and had not gone to war. So I think that the issue of predictability and resolve and credibility, that there is something there, but I'd much rather have a right result at the end.
Let's talk about some of the more recent interventions or military actions. It seems to me that there is a stark contrast in the request for congressional authorization for an intervention in Syria, but no discussion of anything like that in the drone operation in Yemen, which was a response to terrorism chatter just a few weeks ago. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I think that essentially what happened is that President Obama saw the polls. It's striking that he decided to go to Congress, not after consulting with his foreign policy advisors, but after consulting with Dennis McDonough, who obviously is a political person, his chief of staff, and seemed to take his foreign policy people completely by surprise. I think this is, driven by politics, not by foreign policy. I think it would have been great if the drone program in particular had had a broader public airing, and that's probably true of our cyber policy as well. But in this case, really, the problem was less so much going to Congress, but the mixed signals that came before it.
Does credibility come from acting, getting a political consensus, or does credibility come from actually changing the situation on the ground in Syria? And that's something we're not going to know for perhaps another year.
I think it comes from all of that. I mean, I think maybe more than anything else, it comes from a sense of predictability. There's always a certain amount of bluffing in foreign affairs. And I think that, Obama has been very firm about, he's almost painted himself into a corner in terms of the possible use of military action against Iran if it continues with a nuclear program. If that's a case where I'd like to see him be less resolute and back off that position. But I think that he also does feel that if he is going to preserve that ability to change Iranian policy, then he has to be predictable in the case of Syria as well, and that red lines have to mean something.
Finally, is this a legacy question? The administration began with this huge sort of visionary notion of consulting in the world and being a leader and holding a moral vision in this century. And now we're really going to Congress on something that is very, very limited in Syria, even though the humanitarian issue is huge. The trajectory seems away from morality in the Obama administration. I'm wondering if you get that impression.
I think the high point, the high watermark for that was the Libyan intervention. And it really was driven in part by this notion of the responsibility to protect. Samantha Power and Susan Rice were both very firm advocates of the use of military power to reduce suffering abroad, to address mass atrocities abroad. And then since that, that community has really faded. The humanitarian intervention community has diminished to almost nothing. And I think that the entire country, Obama included, is just extraordinarily weary with international action of any kind.
Credibility and weariness. There's a certain tension there. Nicholas Kristof, thanks so much.
Delighted to be with you.
Nicholas Kristof, New York Times columnist, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist for our partner. Thanks. At yesterday's hearings in the House of Representatives, this interesting question was addressed to Secretary of State John Kerry by Representative Steve Chabot of Ohio.
Did the British Parliament not rejected Prime Minister Cameron on the Syria issue, would President Obama have bothered to come to Congress?
I believe he absolutely would have. I think the president was thinking about this. There were discussions to some degree about whether or not it should happen. He hadn't made up his mind. He certainly didn't announce it to us. But my personal belief is, yes.
The president would have asked Congress, according to John Kerry, even if British Prime Minister David Cameron hadn't lost his vote in Parliament last week, where he was seeking authorization to intervene in Syria. The U.S. and Britain not seeing eye to eye on military matters in our time is unusual. Joining us now is Andrew Mitchell, a member of Parliament, former cabinet minister. Welcome.
Good day.
So how do you view this vote? Is it a legacy of the Blair days? You know them well. Are the British MPs and the British people possibly, had it with the cooperating with the United States?
Well, there's no doubt that during the debate in the House of Commons, the ghost of the Blair debates was ever present.
Is there a move to reconsider? And would the reconsideration be because of the so-called special relationship between the U.S. and Britain?
Well, everyone in the House of Commons, everyone in Britain is very focused, I think, on the humanitarian catastrophe that is taking place in Syria and affecting, you know, Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan as well. Now, to your question of whether or not the government will bring back this motion or any motion to the House of Commons on this, the Prime Minister has made it absolutely clear that he does not intend to do so. But, you know, in politics, it's unwise to say that you'll never say never. And if the situation changes, then I argue that the government should be willing to come back to the House of Commons and reconsider the matter. And, you know, things are changing. We've had the release of American intelligence, German intelligence yesterday. We had the appalling attack by a Syrian jet fighter on a primary school using napalm. You know, all of this builds up to a different picture. And I think as events change, we'll see what the US Congress and the House do. But, in the end, if the Congress and the Senate support the president, if there's a motion which gets agreement, that will be discussed in Britain. And people will, you know, they may make a different conclusion in due course in the light of events.
Certainly the chance that things will change and get even worse in Syria is likely, if not actually taking place minute by minute. But I'm wondering if something else is driving this as well, and that is a well-known British, shall we say, intolerance for being kind of out of the loop and irrelevant in world affairs. The idea that France is ahead of London on this one must feel a little odd to the average Brit.
Well, it does to those who take that view. Of course, there are others who will argue that it's right not to have to take military action, and they won't be feeling that. You know, this is an issue which splits the country, and according to recent polling, you know, the majority of Brits don't believe it's right to join with America in this military action. I'm in the minority. I believe passionately that it's the right thing to do. I was the British humanitarian lead and development secretary until last year. I've seen for myself the appalling refugee and humanitarian catastrophe that has engulfed the region. I've looked into the eyes of children who have been shot at as they came across the Syrian border into Jordan. 1 million children now have fled out of that country. 2 million refugees. This is the biggest movement of people on earth since 1994 and the Rwandan genocide, when nearly 2 million people stampeded over the border from Rwanda into Goma and the Congo. So there won't be a military solution to this. The solution will come from the protagonists negotiating. But is military action part of getting to that point? In my view, the answer is yes.
Andrew Mitchell, Member of Parliament for Sutton Coldfield in the UK. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The moments in life are many.
Anyone know what this is, class? Anyone? Anyone seen this before?
The classic moment of ultimate boredom in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. But in a sense, we're all living our own Bueller moments, right? When reality slows down, is that my boss talking to me?
Sure, you do that from now on. That would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure.
It's kind of like walking through the Devil's Emporium. or a store that the devil owns. As you walk around,
when the church sermon starts to sound like a sermon,
we're all trying to do the right thing for our constituents, for our country, and for our national security.
The congressional hearing starts to sound like a congressional hearing. Except in our time, you know, you can just look down, pick up your smartphone or tablet and play a little game. Check your email, deal some poker like Senator John McCain was caught doing earlier this week.
Well, the thing that may disturb people after the initial euphoria is over about this is that...
John McCain himself, whose plodding voice may have inspired a few impromptu digital small screen vacations.
That is a serious step. It's one thing to say you're not going to challenge a law in court or something like that.
Anyway, McCain was called, you may have heard about this, to task for playing poker on his smartphone during that Senate hearing. But these days, don't we all grab a little two-minute vacation wherever we can? We'd love to know from you the answer to this question. I feel perfectly fine about playing solitaire or some other game on my phone when blank is going on. Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Joining us is Sherry Turkle, an MIT technology and society specialist, the author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less of Each Other. Professor Turkle, welcome.
Hi.
So McCain doing this little leisure deal at the hearing didn't bother me at all. It seems to me we all take these little 90-second vacations. So what does that do to us?
Well, it does a lot of things to us. People in my work, people are texting in church. They're texting during corporate board meetings. Parents are texting during breakfast with their kids. I mean, we've come to a point where what we're intolerant of is we're intolerant of the boring bits in life. And there are studies, actually, what are showing that these little breaks are distracting to the people around us. They're distressing to our children who want our full attention. But also when students take these little multitasking breaks in class, they really bring down the performance of the whole class. Who are distracted when people are texting around them or doing little video games around them. So in a way, Senator McCain doing that in something as serious as the Syria hearing, it kind of gives permission for this kind of behavior, just as the texting in class has now become a norm that really is breaking down the performance of what's happening in our classrooms.
Although he would say he's choosing, that basically he does his best work when he's behind closed doors with President Obama, and when the public hearing and the cameras are rolling, it's more boring, so he's going to play some poker, and that's all he's doing. He's more aware of the quality moments rather than the boring moments.
Well, but, you know, we're starting to really find that, you know, we don't know in conversation when the important moments of revelation are going to come. In normal human interchange, we find ourselves sparked at moments that are unpredictable. And the habit that we're getting into of kind of tuning out in lectures means that we can't be in lecture settings. And so we're starting to, you know, design online education so that there are never boring bits, so that things are always kind of coming to us in pellets of exciting, you know, of exciting little mind-sized bits of performance.
Right, sound bites. The sound bites, academia sound bites. Well, we've got, of course, to move on, but it's a great point that solitaire and poker is sort of sucking up our capacity to be surprised. Sherry Turkle, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Sherry Turkle is an MIT professor, author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. It is the case that a far greater toxic disaster for the world in purely environmental terms than Syria's use of chemical weapons is the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex, the site of the worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl. Though it's been more than 2 years since an earthquake and tsunami crippled that plant, the containment and cleanup effort remain incomplete, and earlier this week, the Japanese government added $500 million to that effort. Much of the money now being designated for cleanup will apparently go towards constructing a frozen wall to prevent groundwater from reaching the contaminated buildings. Arjun Makijani is an engineering specialist in nuclear fusion and the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Arjun, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, this frozen wall idea, in purely engineering terms, how is that different from just any other wall?
Well, a frozen wall means you have refrigerant, as in your freezer at home, circulating in the soil. In this case, I understand it would be liquid nitrogen, and it would freeze the water in the pores of the soil. So it would literally be an ice wall, depending on that power supply and that refrigerant and the integrity of the tubes, to kind of build an underground dam to hold back the water from getting into the site and becoming contaminated.
But as an engineer, you know how Fukushima got into this problem. The tsunami and the earthquake disrupted the power source for the cooling system in the plant, and this frozen wall would depend on a continuous power supply for a cooling system to keep the nitrogen liquefied. How can that be guaranteed?
It can't be guaranteed, obviously. And they are cognizant of this problem. This cannot be more than a palliative. It's a giant experiment on a highly radioactive site. It isn't that ice walls haven't been built before, but this one would be far larger, and it would be built in a highly radioactive environment. Workers would have significant exposures, would take a long time. And then, of course, if there were an earthquake or loss of power after some time, the ice wall would melt. And now you have accumulated radioactive water that would surge through and go to the ocean. They've already built a chemical impregnated wall to hold back water, and it was overtopped. There are 300 tons a day of contaminated water flowing into the ocean from Fukushima as we speak.
Now, I'm not an engineer, but I'm detecting a certain amount of skepticism from you regarding this plan of the Japanese. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong. I'm not saying they shouldn't build it, but I think trying to manage the water on site and accumulating so much highly contaminated water. Remember, now there are measurements of radioactivity near these tanks that could cause a lethal dose in a few hours. So we're talking extremely highly radioactive material that is complicating the management of this accident, which really should be centered on getting the molten fuel out of these reactors. I have suggested that they buy a super tanker, which would be cheaper than an ice wall, and really empty these tanks into a super tanker and send it elsewhere for extracting the radioactive waste and cleaning it up. But the authorities back then in 2011 rejected the idea. I haven't sent it formally now, but I think an ice wall at best will be an expensive temporary palliative with some risks.
Let's talk about the palliative. It sounds like the ice wall is more of a psychological fix for the Japanese who want this to just sort of go away and be behind a wall, as opposed to a purely engineering fix. And if we're talking about psychology, your idea of a supertanker, putting nuclear waste into a supertanker floating in the ocean, that's not going to pass muster politically in Japan.
Well, it didn't, obviously. I'm not saying an ice wall is just a psychological palliative. I think it's a technical palliative. It could hold back the problem for some time. And then you're at the mercy, basically, of Mother Nature, who may or may not be kind. And in the past, it was not kind. And so it's the responsibility of human beings to make sure that they take that into account.
Are we seeing essentially the manifestations of what is fundamentally a design flaw in the nuclear fission reactor, in a sense that there are many scenarios now that we can see where a disaster produces an environmental catastrophe that exceeds our capacity to manage because it will go on for hundreds of thousands of years?
Well, clearly it does exceed our capacity to manage it. And I think the mismanagement on site has made it much worse. For instance, they have been, as I understand from the press, offered robotic technology to cut up the molten fuel, which is really the source of this problem primarily. And they have wanted to give contracts internally in Japan mainly, and it's become part of the old boy cozy nuclear network that seems to have gotten Japan in the problem in the first place. Now they're saying they will take international help, but it remains to be seen how serious that is.
We're talking with Arjun Makhijani, who's an engineering specialist in nuclear fusion, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Who does this better? I mean, there are utilities all over the world that are responsible for nuclear reactors. And is it a management question or really just a design flaw in the whole operation of nuclear fission reactors?
Well, all commercial reactors are subject to catastrophic accidents. These reactors at Fukushima were older and in many ways more vulnerable because their containment buildings were not as strong as Three Mile Island. So the older reactors do have design problems. We have 31 of them in this country, in the United States. So there are design problems, and obviously there has been a management problem and a regulatory problem. Regulatory oversight tends to vary a lot around the world, better in Japan than the Soviet Union, a little bit better in the United States than Japan, but everywhere I think regulation tends to be a little on the lax side in my book, given that there can be catastrophic accidents like Fukushima.
Arjun Makhijani is an engineering specialist in nuclear fusion and president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Arjun, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Today we heard from a Democratic congressman from Oregon who said his constituents are running 90% against intervention in Syria. We're also polling constituents around the country for their views on whether the U.S. should intervene in Syria.
This is Jennifer Steinberg in Blinn, Washington. And I'm calling in to say I support the strike. We ignored World War II until they bombed us. And in the meantime, thousands and thousands of innocent people were gassed. So I say, go, Obama.
Elizabeth calling from Rockwall, Texas. I don't think we need to go into this battle going on over there overseas. You don't justify taking a motion against many lives by killing a bunch more people.
So surprising opinions, split views. We're getting a lot of different views on this. My next guest does not speak for the more than 150,000 Syrian Americans in the U.S., but he is one of them. He was born and raised in Syria, now lives in Miami, Florida. Hadi Yazici is a Syrian American. Hadi, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So what's your view on the question of what's going on in your country and whether the U.S. should intervene? A lot of talk about Syria, your home, over the last few weeks.
Sure. Well, I mean, in order to answer the question of whether the U.S. should intervene, we have to just take a step back and look at what actually is happening and what caused it. Syria, unfortunately, is a battleground not for freedom and democracy. It's a battleground of outside interests. There are multiple wars going on in Syria that Syrian people have nothing to do with. Russia and the U.S., they want to exercise control over the area, and Syria is a strategic ally of Russia. Syrian people have nothing to do with that. Russia and Iran on one side, and U.S. and Israel on the other side. Saudi Arabia against Iran, battling Iran in Syria. The Syrian people have nothing to do with that. So when we talked earlier, I think Nicholas Kirchhoff mentioned, or Kurt Schreider, the congressman, mentioned that a lot of the people fighting the Syrian military are foreign fighters. That is true, absolutely true. Some of them don't even speak Arabic because they're Chechens.
Well, what do you think of Bashar al-Assad and the attack that motivated all of this latest talk?
Well, we have to, when any massive massacre at this scale happens, we really have to investigate. Where is the investigation? Let's allow the UN investigators finish their work and find out some more. The evidence, the so-called evidence that presented to the Foreign Relations Committee behind closed doors is based on a third-party intelligence. We're done with third-party intelligence.
All right, but you don't believe that Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, and are you a supporter of the current regime in Syria?
I am not. I'm part of the opposition, but I'm part of the nonviolent opposition. The question whether we believe Bashar al-Assad did order somebody to launch chemical-loaded rockets is possible. It's a possibility. But in the end of the day, we have to look at who's the beneficiary of this. President Obama drew the red line and gave a cue to some people to do it. Now, the regime is a mad regime, but it's not that mad that at the day of the arrival of the UN's chemical weapons inspectors that they will decide to do something at this scale the day the inspectors arrived. There are some reports. One of them is from an AP journalist, Associated Press journalist, who was reporting for another organization called Mint Press. They had a journalist on the ground interviewing the rebels, and they said that they got these rockets from Saudi Arabia, from Bandar bin Sultan, and his nickname is Al-Habib. Al-Habib in Arabic means the lover. So we have to look at these things.
Right.
That doesn't implicate him or doesn't implicate Saudi Arabia or somebody else, but we have to look at these things. What concerns me is the Foreign Relations Committee hearing was actually a joke. I mean, Rand Paul is right. He is right. It was a joke. They made a decision to go to war, and they're shoving it down the throat of Congress to agree. The American people have spoken. Every congressperson will tell you that the calls for no versus yes are like 95-98% versus 2%.
Well, that certainly was reflected in the House Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday. Hadi Azizi is a Syrian-American living in Florida. You don't speak for 150,000 Syrian-Americans in the U.S., but obviously following this very, very closely. Hadi, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So to intervene or not to intervene, that's the question. Let's hear from the interveners.
This is Amjad from North Attleboro in Massachusetts, and I'm calling to say yes for the intervention in Syria to stop the killing of children, women, and innocent people. I hope the Congress will come with the right decisions and that we will learn how to teach our children the responsibility by protecting other children.
Hello, my name is Ani. I'm calling from San Jose, California. My take is that I don't think we should be arming the rebels. If Turkey wants to go to war in Syria, they can go right ahead. They share a border, and it's a bigger security issue for them than for the United States.
This is John Ambrose calling from New York, and I want to support limited strikes so that this arrogant president will not have the ability to kill his own people anymore.
Now, that's one set of views, but on the other side, please, no intervention.
Hi, my name is Ellen, and I'm calling from Plaistow, New Hampshire. And my view on Syria is that, no, we should not get involved in any way. I do understand it's a horrific, horrific crime against humanity, and children are getting killed, and innocents are losing their life. But they're losing their life in our country, too. We are allowing children to get mowed down in schools and on the streets. And we're allowing children in this country to go to get hungry. We are doing a bad job.
Rick, calling from Dallas, Texas. I think it's crazy that we continue to ignore the fact that the CIA is and has been training, arming, supporting logically Al-Qaeda and Muslim fundamentalist terrorists. We're calling those people rebels. Those are not people that we want in charge of the government. It is absolutely insane, whether there's chemical weapons used or not, that is our plan.
My name's Dave. I'm calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. The only people who truly benefit from a war in Syria is the military-industrial complex and Al-Qaeda.
Split opinions out there from you and a lot of questions.
This is Dave from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And my question for the president today would be, if we do a targeted strike in Syria, isn't that a provocation of war, a declaration of war on the country of Syria?
This is Doug McWilliam from Charlotte, North Carolina. What about the boots on the ground in Turkey with the missile systems? What about the boots on the ground in Jordan? training the Jordan army. If a war breaks out, aren't they at risk, and aren't they, in fact, boots on the ground already?
Patricia Murphy, San Antonio, Texas. The people on Capitol Hill need to start looking forward on who's going to take over Syria when they get rid of Assad.
Thoughtful questions there and comments from all the listeners. Thanks to all of you, particularly that comment from Doug McWilliams from Charlotte, North Carolina. There are U.S. military personnel in the region, certainly in Turkey and in Jordan. What would happen if the conflict goes wider? Do you support the president's plan for a limited strike on Syria? Are you opposed to it? Do you have questions you need answered? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. Be a part of the conversation and the debate. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.